plant blindness is maybe a bit of a strange notion, because it's not blind, it's more like color blindness. It's not that we don't see anything, but oftentimes we do tend to overlook plants, or at least they're less interesting than, for instance, animals. If we have a house animal, this is very different from having a house plant, for instance. We don't really deal with them the same way.
This is Future Based Podcast with your host, Sabine Winters.
I mean, maybe lots of people do know about photosynthesis, but there's many other complexities of plants that we just don't have our eye on.
FutureBase is a philosophy platform that is not fettered to time and space, where collaborations arise, encounters take place, and projects are initiated. For more information, visit futurebased.org.
Yeah, I think we do underestimate the complexities of plant life. Mm. Plants, for instance, are wonderful alchemists. So they take only a few ingredients, sunlight, water, CO2, a couple of minerals, and they make the most fantastic molecular structures.
Norbert Peters is a botanical philosopher, and his research is focused on an investigation of the philosophical and historical roots, implicit founding presuppositions, and the argumentative structure of the concept of wilderness, and its practical application in the Dutch wildlife conservation projects. In this podcast, Norbert will explain his passion for plants and the fascination and underexposed relationship Darwin had with plants. We will talk about what plant blindness is and where it comes from, and why we are on a structural base undermining the complexity and awesomeness of plants.
We're in my study room, which is in Leiden, yeah. University town. Just outside of Amsterdam. I'm living in the old center, so I have a beautiful view of the St. Pancras Church here in Leiden, and we're in quite an old house. And this is my study. This is where the magic happens.
Yes, it's full of where, books.
Exactly, it's full of books, fossils, plant stuff, and this is where I love to work. So I started studying archaeology. This was just basically a childhood passion of mine. A bit on the influence of movies like Indiana Jones, yeah. Although archaeology is nothing like an Indiana Jones movie. But I was very interested in human origins, especially, and in prehistory. I studied that, but I was unsatisfied that I couldn't do a more theoretical track. Archaeology is quite a practical study. And I was doing excavations here in the Netherlands. And although I liked doing excavations, I still wanted to be a student. I still wanted to learn more. It took me a while to adjust to academia. And then I sort of floated around a little bit, doing all sorts of subjects. And then I ended up with philosophy. Starting again, doing a bachelor and a master. Came under the influence of a teacher of mine, for whom I was an assistant for many years, Wouter Oudemans, who was a professor of philosophy and philosophical anthropology here in Leiden. And during my studies, I started to focus more and more on the philosophy of biology and on the work of Darwin, Nietzsche, quite late philosophy, and also quite a lot of biology and evolutionary theory. And by the end of my studies, I was his assistant for quite some time. He decided to basically make an arboretum, a tree garden, up in Groningen, the northern provinces. And there he had a collection of trees, and he wanted to make a map of this park that he built. And I had some experience with doing measurements and making digital maps from my archaeology past. So I was starting to make that map, and we were talking about botany for quite some time. He has a famous great-grandfather of his was a famous botanist, so we started to talk more and more about botany and came to the realization that philosophy doesn't really do a lot with botany these days. So philosophy is usually concerned with human beings and all sorts of other subjects, and a little bit of animal philosophy is now seeping in the last 100 years or so. But plant philosophy, there wasn't really a precedent. Even though there's quite a lot of philosophers have written about plants, Kant, Descartes, Heidegger, and Nietzsche wrote about plants. So there was quite a lot of material. So we decided to start to write a book, which is called Plantaardig, which is like it's not easily translated in English, but it's like plantliness. more or less. A vegetative philosophy, we called it. Mm-hmm. So this was written basically under his guidance. So he also decided on much of the things that we discussed in the book. And I had to study, of course, quite a lot for this book, and I had to read up on botany and follow classes in botany and do all sorts of excursions to gain more knowledge on this subject. And then I found out basically quite late, even though I was already dealing with Darwin for quite some time, that Darwin was also a well-known botanist and actually wrote extensively on the subject, and like one third of all his written works are on plants, which I did not realize. So this was an excellent opportunity to write another book, or write my own debut, which was Botanical Revolution, The Plant Studies of Charles Darwin.
How many times a day do you really notice the plants around you? I would bet not very often. And if we do notice them, it is because they are providing us, for example, with food, shadow, or decorating our homes. But often when we notice them, and they are not directly serving our needs, we very quickly tend to think of plants as a nuisance. But to think about all the leaves that are falling off trees and creating a mess in our streets and gardens, or the really beautiful dandelion that is seen as a weed we should get rid of as soon as possible. Preconceptions about plants are still that they are passive and simple organisms that should definitely not be in the way because they don't have a life of their own, right?
Plant blindness is basically a concept from child studies. There was two botanists in America, James Van Der Zee and Elizabeth Schussler, and in, I think it was 1999, they wrote a paper on plant blindness because they discovered that, and this is actually, it's common sense that people oftentimes overlook plants. They don't really notice plants. Not that we don't see plants. So plant blindness is maybe a bit of a strange notion because it's not blind, it's more like color blindness. It's not that we don't see anything. It's not that we don't appreciate plants, for instance. I mean, we buy flowers, we have house plants, we like to walk in the park. But oftentimes we do tend to overlook plants, or at least place them, they're less interesting than, for instance, animals. So we very much, animals draw our attention a lot quicker than a plant does. If we have a house animal, this is very different from having a house plant, for instance. We don't really deal with them the same way. So we have this sort of negligence towards the plant kingdom. Mm-hmm. And also we tend to not have a lot of knowledge on plants, even though that the botanical sciences have greatly grown and were very influential and lots of cool discoveries were made. These didn't really seep through to the common crowd, basically. So for instance, last summer was very dry in the Netherlands, and then there was this paint company who you could hire to paint your garden green. So all the plants that were suffering from the drought, they of course turned brown, and then they could come by and they could paint them green. And this was actually just gone viral. People were excited about this this notion, and it just goes to show, like, lots of people don't really necessarily know what the importance, why are plants green, and what does this mean that they are green, and what does photosynthesis mean, lots of people do know about photosynthesis, but there's many other complexities of plants that we just don't have our eye on.
The intermezzos, like the one you are listening to right now, are the representation of the complex internal processes of the Arabidopsis plant, translated into music. The Arabidopsis Symphony is a project by Philips Studios in collaboration with the Department of Plant Physiology of the Wageningen University. It explores the capabilities of plants to make music, a plant orchestra created by translating growth data into sound. Composer of the plant music is Falk Huckner. For more information, visit philipsstudios.com.
Plants that are that have an economic importance, we very much talk about them as their sort of subordinates to human beings. Mm-hmm. We are the master in their domain. We sow them, we take out the weeds, we fertilize them, we give them water, we tend to them, and this is basically, it is almost like a master subordinate sort of relationship. At least this is how we talk oftentimes when we talk about agriculture. Same thing is true for domesticated animals, I think. And a weird thing is, and this was first, I first read this, it was the first book on botany I read, was by Michael Pollan, The Botany of Desire, which is a very interesting book. And it starts with this notion of how certain are we that this this relation is true? Are we the masters and they're the subordinates? Or could you also, for instance, change that around? And he has all these thoughts experiments, and there's also different writers that have similar thoughts experiments, like if an alien would visit our planet and it would have to decide who's the boss, the dog or the dog owner. I mean, the dog owner cleans up the shit and takes it out for a walk, the dog doesn't have to work, the owner has to work too. So you could say, like, in a certain sense, isn't the dog the master in this relationship? And I think you can say the same thing about plants. We have taken... for instance, we have taken a maize and or a corn, rice and I forget the English word for, yeah. Well, you don't want to say weed. well, I don't want to. Well, yeah, I mean, they started off as very simple grasses. One in Asia, one in the Middle East, and one in the Americas. And this, I mean, if you look at the wild ancestor of maize, not a very interesting plant. I mean, it's very small and only has a couple of seeds and doesn't really look like anything much, and doesn't have like a wide range or anything. But today, I mean, these plants together constitute 50% of our calorie intake a day.
Yeah.
For most people on this planet, and they've become hugely successful. And we've, you know, we've cleared forests and we've cleared huge swaths of land just to give these plants a place and to make sure that they reproduce and to make sure that they're happy and that they grow and that we can harvest them. And so you could, and also this has had so many consequences on human life. I mean, we were, for thousands of years, we were nomadic hunter-gatherers. Who were not really bound to a certain place. I mean, there's certain places, but we were not sedentary as we were when we started to become agricultural. So we needed to mimic the plant in a certain sense. You know, the plant is stuck to the ground, and so we need to be stuck to a certain spot too if you want to live off of plants. And this is so...
A highly interdependent relationship.
Highly interdependent. I mean, could be better described as almost a symbiosis of the two, where there's a mutual, there's a mutual dependence, mm-hmm, on one another. You can't just take away. I think there's a lovely book that was written some time ago, The Death of Grass, which is a fiction book. It's a sort of a dystopian novel, but very realistic in a certain sense, that there's this disease that's there for and that destroys rice species. I think it's in China or something, and then this disease, this virus, mutates, and it sort of affects all the whole grass family, disappears almost in, you know, no time, and we are so dependent on a few species of this grass family that this has, of course, terrible consequences for human beings. This is what this book is about. This is what the book discusses, at least. But this is not an alien notion. This is not something that couldn't happen. Actually, it is happening. There's many, many plants that, because they're monocultures and oftentimes they don't sexually reproduce, they're very vulnerable to virus attacks and fungi attacks, and plants get sick too. And this is even worse when you have so many plants that are clones of one another or very genetically very similar to one another. They're so susceptible to diseases that we notice this all around. The banana has been attacked and is still attacked by fungal diseases, but many, many plants are, and this causes all sorts of problems. So this is not even such an alien notion. This dystopia is basically very much a reality. I mean, it's not as bad as in the book, but it could definitely get worse.
What would be an utopia for you?
in your perspective?
That's a good... Yeah, I mean, usually I...
Regarding planned relationships.
Yeah, because usually the one that makes the utopia is usually that's very dystopic because, you know, a utopia usually...
Never works out well.
Never works out well and it has a dictatorial notion to or association. But what I do find, maybe it's not, it's, you know, I don't want to propose big changes, but what I do sometimes find strange is that much of this knowledge that botany has given us is so little known, and I think that's a shame in a certain sense, because as soon as you know a little bit more about plants, you start, I mean it's very hard to see them very different. So I think we're still very much under the influence of Aristotle and viewing plants as passive, simple beings. I think it's very hard to sidestep that notion. I have a cat and I have many houseplants, but I take a lot more care of my cat than I do of my houseplant. I mean, I like my houseplants too, but I definitely don't have the same relationship as I do with my cat. But then I do think that if you... talk more about plants, and if we get to know a little bit more about the complexities of plant life, this does help to look at them very differently. Like you walking from the station to here, looking at differently at trees. So, for instance, when I first started reading on plant sleep, you have this idea that plants change the position of their leaves during the night, and sometimes this is very complex, sometimes it's a very simple movement, but they do that, and I never noticed that. And then as soon as you do notice that, you'll find some plants. I mean, this is not a good time in the fall, but especially in the spring and the summer, you'll find plants in the cities that have sort of gone to sleep. They're not really sleeping like we are sleeping, but I mean, you start to notice that. And then, if we, you know, maybe should give a little bit more attention to plants, also because we're so highly dependent on plants. I think I don't have a recipe for a better world, but I do think that if you were looking for a recipe for a better world, then plant life is one of the first things you need to think about.
Do we take them for too much for granted?
I think so, largely, yeah, because we're so dependent on them, and yet we give them hardly any attention. I mean, we live directly and indirectly off of plants. I mean, even if we're eating meat, you're basically indirectly eating grasses, or you're eating soya, or everything, life on Earth is dependent on plant life on Earth. I sometimes say to people that we live in the shade of a plant, sort of as this notion of, lately it's been more and more popular to talk about our current times as the Anthropocene, and I always think that in a certain sense, it's very true that humans have become a geological force to be reckoned with. But I think we shouldn't forget that we have become this almost geological force is almost completely because of the way we deal with plants. I mean, plants provide not only the oxygen, and they make sure that not everything erodes away, and they give us shade and all these types of things. But much more important, of course, is the food that they give and the drinks, or at least for us, much more important is the drinks, the food, the medicine. Still, a large part of our medicine cabinet is still plant based. Even the synthesized medicinal products are oftentimes based on plant products, and yeah, I think we do underestimate the complexities of plant life. Mm-hmm. Plants, for instance, are wonderful alchemists, so they take only a few ingredients: sunlight, water, CO2, a couple of minerals, and they make the most fantastic molecular structures. You know, if you think about opium, for instance, or you think about nicotine, or you think about rubber, or you think about all these different plant products that are made from the most simple of ingredients, which is just so fascinating, and just goes to show that plants have wonderfully adapted to their way of life. If you want to stay rooted to the spot, it's very, very important that you have a very good chemical set with you.
Adapt.
Yes.
So plants are very ingenious, complex organisms. A very philosophical question is, though, when does complex become intelligent?
I think the nice thing about plant psychology, I was thinking about this morning, like, psychology is, of course, made out of two Greek words. And the first word is used by Aristotle to describe this, what we would call the soul, although soul is a bit of a convoluted notion because of Christianity. But he talks about different types of souls. And Aristotle was very keen to say that, plants have a vegetative soul, which means they can grow and flower and wilt away. And then you have animals, and they have this vegetative soul as well, but they also have an animal soul, which is sort of, makes them able to be animate, to move around, to have sensory organs, et cetera, et cetera. And then humans also have these two souls, but also have this rationality, which is also then basically the human soul. But we still use that. I mean, if you talk about, so in Dutch you can say kostplantje, but if you talk about somebody who is a vegetable, that just means that they'd lost their sensory powers and they'd lost their brain function. Yeah, vegetative state, you would say. Yeah, that's more correctly. In a certain sense, in plant science, and I think Darwin played a large part of it, that's why I called it botanical revolution, because this view of plants is still very, this Aristotelian view on plants is still very, very much all around. But lots has changed. So one of the first things that happened was that in the 18th century, people started noticing that some plants were anomalies, had characteristics that didn't seem to belong to the plant kingdom. So, for instance, we have the Venus flytrap. The Venus flytrap that has this the little mouth that closes if you touch it. Or you have like a mimosa plant, a Mimosa pudica, which is a touch me not plant. If you touch it, then the leaves fold together. And when these were first discovered, this was very strange to scientists of the time, and because how to think of this, is this actually a plant we're dealing with? Mm. And they even made a special category, like an in-between step between animals and human, or animals and plants. There's this zoophyte, they would say. And then zoophytes were plants that had animalistic tendencies. They could move, or they could respond to touch, or they could do all sorts of things.
Yes. It was one of the favorites of Darwin, wasn't it? The Venus, not the Venus trap?
Venus flytrap, yeah. He wrote extensively on carnivorous plants. He was the first to scientifically prove, basically, not just how plants eat victims and catch them, but also why.
Yeah.
This notion was already about that there were carnivorous plants, but nobody knew why they were doing this. Some people thought they were almost like taking revenge for all the plants that were eaten by insects and herbivores, etc. And so people thought it was sort of these plants sort of shifted, the whole world on flipped the play and started to eat insects. And then Darwin showed that most of the plants live in very nutrient-poor environments, swamps or hillsides that are very rocky with very little soil, and they were actually catching insects to get minerals. So this was actually more of a fertilizer more than actual food. But he wrote a big book, Insectivorous Plants, in which he discusses all these different plants that have carnivorous tendencies.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, is a very nice notion, and this insect plant study sort of set in motion more research into plant physiology, and this is what really changed the outlook on plants. So he wrote his last book on botany. It's called The Power of Movement in Plants, and this is almost a direct attack on this Aristotelian notion of a passive plant. In which he shows, before there was time lapse, he didn't have cameras, he didn't have anything, but he had very nice experiments, and he showed that plants do move about, and that if you speed up time, then actually all plants seem to move about, and that movement was actually commonly there in the plant kingdom. Now, some plants move very quickly. So the Venus flytrapers is a quick-moving plant, and the touch-me-not plant is similar. But for instance, climbing plants also move quite quickly. We don't really see them move, but we do know that they move because they get about quite quickly. And then even trees, and now we have timeless images, so now we can, he would love to have seen timeless images, because then really this whole plant world seems to come alive. And when some philosophers, I forget, there's one of which I forgot the name, but he saw one of the first time lapses of a tulip blooming, and he was just amazed that this whole kingdom started, almost awoke in his mind, and almost had like it almost seemed willed. You know, if you see a tendril of a vine circling around, it's very difficult not to say that it's searching for support. So a big section of this book, Power of Movement in Plants, is actually about plant roots, and especially about the first root that more or less appears when a seed germinates. And this root, he showed, has all these sensory qualities.
Yeah.
So this is basically the second step. So at first he showed all plants move, and then he showed that plants not only move willy-nilly, but they sense their environment, and they are capable of dealing with sensory information.
Perceiving
the world. Yeah, and especially perceiving differences in light. And for roots, it's, for instance, it's the direction of gravity, which is very important. So why do roots grow down and plant shoots grow up? This is because of a sensory relation it has with its environment, where it can measure the direction of gravity and grow in that direction. And not only gravity, but we found out plants have many, 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 many more environmental cues that they use to navigate through the world, which is just such a strange notion. So this is basically the second part of this big study, where he shows that plants are sensory organisms. And then we get to plant psychology. Well, at the end of this book, we get at plant psychology, which is Darwin did something very... Because he's always, he tends to hold back quite a lot. He tends to not say things that are uncorroborated. He likes to have like his correspondents check up on certain facts, and he doesn't like writing things down that he hasn't checked or tested or whatever. He's very careful in that way. And then he has this big book, Power of Movement in Plants, and sensory information and how plants react to that. So basically, this is the second level in this Aristotelian cake. So now plants appear to have this animal soul to them. They appear to be just like animals, be capable of all these other these animalistic qualities, or what we would call animalistic qualities. And then you reach this last level, and then this is reserved for the end of the book. So in the last paragraph of this book, he sort of says, well, okay, well, now I've discussed in length what a plant root does. So it has all these different sensory cues, and based on these cues, it decides what direction to grow in. And then you get this notion of, well, it doesn't use the word decide, I should say, but you could say decide in a certain sense. It deliberates. It has to make a decision based on different environmental cues. And this is, for him, very closely related to what intelligence is. When you consider intelligence. So he says, you know, shouldn't we draw the analogy between the root tip and the frontal parts, basically, of an insect, for instance, like an earthworm? So just like the earthworm has, you know, in his head has his basically a very simple nerve-like system. This root also has a similar thing going on, or at least it's comparable to that, because this root tip, because he notices that the sensory cues are registered by the root tip and not by anything, and then the root tip decides for the rest of the root in which direction to grow. Yeah, what is this? What is its decision-making ability?
Yeah.
Shouldn't we call this intelligence? We'll be right back. you know, it's we have to be a little bit careful when we tread this area, when we talk about things like intelligence, because it's very easy to anthropomorphize animals, but also definitely also plants, and this has happened for quite some time.
Is this necessarily wrong, though?
To anthropomorphize? Well, I mean, it's not. I mean, it's not in a certain sense not wrong. If it's for a Disney film, there's not a problem. But if we start to, well, say for instance that plants have a sort of brain-like structure, or that plants, for instance, have some people have instances that say like, well, yeah, plants are able to feel pain. Which is very
This is one of the things that is coming back in the documentary of intelligent trees, right? So
yeah, and I think this is we should be hesitant to talk about pain, for instance, because pain is a very specific thing in biology. Pain is a very important signal that you should, you know, move away, get out of there. In that sense, it's very important. And one of the things that plants lack is the ability to escape. So I would say, for instance, that plants are very much capable of defending themselves. So if they are destroyed or if they're hurt in any certain sense, then they can respond to that. And they actually have quite a lot of responses to that. It's not just... for instance, they can heal wounds, for instance. So if they get a wound, they produce certain substances to close this wound, to not have bacterial infections or fungal infections. But they can also up some of the... they can also produce stuff that makes them very disgusting. So they can, for instance, produce certain...
bitterness
to you know, withhold herbivores from eating too much foliage, and they can even, and this is a little bit more bizarre, but what they found out among certain plant species, and we don't know how widely this is distributed in the plant kingdom, and what seems to happen with certain plants is that they can produce chemical cues which sort of waft into the air, and these cues are sort of SOS signals that can be picked up by enemies of these herbivores that they're attacking them. So there's, for instance, a certain parasitic wasp, and they can be called into action, basically, as sort of like bodyguards. So they get... So a caterpillar starts munching on a leaf, and then it produces this cue, and then this parasitic wasp then attacks the caterpillar, which is, of course, very strange, because this is... You could say this is communication, this is a use of language. And then I would very quickly say, well, this is maybe a good example of what we could call plant intelligence. Because, well, there's lots going on. What does the plant need to be able to do in order to produce this type of behavior? It needs to be able, for instance, to recognize its enemy, which is very strange, because how the plant needs to identify. Because... if you want to call in the help of a parasitic wasp, you better be heard by a herbivore that's actually, you know, of which this parasitic wasp is actually the enemy, and otherwise there's no use in calling in the cavalry. So this is very strange. So there's sort of identification going on, there's communication going on. And I think that Darwin's notion is in a certain sense correct, that intelligence, in a very... very basically put, intelligence has to do with deliberation, has to do with you get multiple environmental cues and you have to make up your mind, basically. Mm-hmm. Now, plants don't have a mind in that sense, but they can make it up. And this is, I think, what's interesting. And to anthropomorphize this, when you, for instance, say, well, they feel pain... that this really goes against what the meaning is of pain, what the biological function is of pain. I would say they have very complex reactions to disaster, to being wounded.
When is complex?
there's this sort of animal-like thing, which is called a tunicate, which we in Dutch we call a zakpipe, which is basically a bagpipe, which is a sort of... Well, it's a strange looking animal. You wouldn't even maybe call it an animal in its adult phase, but when it, in its larval phase, it has a very simple brain like structure, and this brain like structure is used to sense its environment, and to navigate through its environment, and then it has, I think it only has a certain number of hours to find a spot, then it attaches itself to a spot, and then it dissolves most of its brain. And I think, in a certain sense, this tells us something about a difference between being stationary and being mobile in a world. So I think for brain development, if evolutionary speaking from an evolutionary perspective, I think our development of our brain is mostly tied to the fact that we move about in a world, that we are carnivorous in a certain sense. You know, we need to hunt or stalk prey, or at least we had to do that for quite some time. So this has put selective pressures on having a brain-like structure to very immediately interact with the world and make predictions about how to behave. Now, I think if you're stationary and if your main food source is sunlight, which is, well, very easy to hunt down, at least when you're not in the shade, it has less selective pressures on brain-like organs. Also, it would be detrimental to the survival of a plant to have vital organs, for instance. Plants are basically very much like a coral reef. They have this modular structure which repeats itself almost like a fractal. And this gives them a great defense for being in one spot, because if you don't eat the whole plant, it can still survive. A little branch can, grow out into a new tree or a new plant. They have lots of seeds also, and so they reproduce quite extensively. So the words we usually use when we talk about intelligence are very human-like characteristics, and genius, or thinking very far ahead, or making very difficult deliberations about life or whatever. This is usually what we think about when we think about intelligence. And I think we should, in a certain sense, see intelligence as this much broader phenomenon, which is not really necessarily linked to a brain-like structure. So I think this is a notion that you see slowly blooming, where people are realizing that maybe that you can be intelligent without a brain. In a certain sense, language philosophy, where we still oftentimes, when we think of language, have this, at least for, when you're a philosophy student, you do lots of philosophy of language. And then when you talk to people on the outside world, you actually notice that lots of quite old school language philosophy ideas are still very viral, very much around. For instance, this notion that a word needs to denote a certain thing, or that a word has an essential distinctive definition. And of course you can define words. I'm not saying that you can, but this is definitely not a way to. Words can be used in very, very, very many ways. But when we think about intelligence, oftentimes we define it as a human-like characteristic, which makes it very hard to give other or to consider the notion that other things have intelligence as well.
It remains a bit of a hassle attributing intelligence to other life forms. Maybe it has something to do with convenience, because when we start talking about what intelligence means and what it refers to, it also might hold that other life forms are intelligent and perhaps hold more complex life structures than our own. This means we might have to reconsider our thinking about other species and rethinking our behavior towards them. In short, we need to talk about ethics.
Definitely. It's very easy. So, this ethical consideration is this is very interesting to me as well, because, and it also, well, we can sort of sidetrack a little bit into the ethical domain. So, for instance, if people for the first time realize that, for instance, milk chicks are destroyed on a large scale because they're not useful for the poultry industry, this is sort of like an embryo, or at least it's just started developing. And we feel very sad when we see this. This is sort of a, or at least I would think most people don't, you know, they're not happy seeing this. And but for instance, if you take an avocado pit, then even though this is also an embryo, this is a highly developed organism, you don't have the same ethical consideration. Yeah. Even though they're both embryos, and in and of themselves, they're both highly complex. So yeah, this is strange, and I think it's also for our convenience. It's definitely also for our convenience that we don't take this into ethical consideration, and this also goes to show how long away we still have to go, maybe, to even consider them to be sensory organisms, let alone intelligent organisms. So I think there's a long way to still go, and to have this realization. But I think also it's not so much that. It's not so much plant intelligence. I think just intelligence in general. I think you would have to go down to the origins of life almost to, because I think and you see this also with artificial intelligence, that now that it's become easier to talk about artificial intelligence and self-learning algorithms and stuff like that, and I think this has also opened up the possibility for thinking about other forms of intelligence outside of our our human intelligence. So what you see is sort of like a seeping down. So first, you know, Darwin was convinced that, you know, the higher apes had forms of intelligence, but he also had the notion that, you know, lower, what he calls lower forms of life also have maybe like something similar to intelligence. And I think this notion has come to fruition more and more. And, you know, now we know that many animals are highly intelligent. We also start to notice that animals we didn't think were intelligent are actually highly intelligent. So birds, and especially corvids, these last decades have really changed the way we viewed intelligence in the animal kingdom. Corvids have very small neocortex, but they are capable of amazing intellectual feats. There's two realizations that need to occur. One is that intelligence, but also as human beings, but intelligence in general, is maybe not such a strange, unique thing that only came about once in evolutionary history, but it's actually widely shared throughout the animal kingdom, and maybe also throughout fungi, throughout plants, throughout bacteria. We're starting to notice more and more and more, and I think we started to notice more and more that intelligence is actually widely there, especially like if you take a intelligence as a basic notion of decision-making, goal-oriented behavior. I think if you take, and I think this could be quite an accurate definition of what intelligence might mean. And then it includes many, many things. It includes artificial intelligence, but it also includes maybe intelligence maybe in the among fungi, intelligence maybe among bacteria. But also we should take into account, which is difficult to do, that plants are very different from us. We share a common ancestor, but this is a long, long, long time ago. We're talking about like a billion years. This means that plants have had to develop very other or very different strategies for coping with surviving. They survived as stationary beings, as modular organisms, and we need to take these differences into account as well. So if there is something called plant intelligence, it might be very different from what we tend to call intelligence. And I think this is also something that we need to think about. Maybe, you know, you had this paper in philosophy, what's it like to be a bat? And I think this is even more so. What's it like to be a plant? I think it's a very difficult question to ask. Also because a plant is not an individual, for instance. And maybe we should also not consider humans to be individuals, because we have many, many other organisms in us and surrounding us and influencing us. But yeah, I think it's very difficult to think what it's like to be a plant. But I think that plant scientists have at least discovered many, many things about plants, and that we should take these discoveries more seriously and maybe see them also that how interesting they are.
So we are closing this podcast episode with a chat of philosophy of mind. And when you go outside or you look at your houseplants, maybe right now, you might have lost a little bit of your plant blindness. So what is it like to be a plant, and how can we understand these very different life forms around us? Plants are awesome, and during the meetup next week about technological ecology on the 25th of February in Amsterdam, among other, Norbert Peters will tell more about plants and how they inspired engineers inventing new technologies. For tickets and information about this meetup and or the show notes, please visit futurebase.org. For more information about Norbert, visit botanischephilosophie.nl. And for more information about the Arabidopsis symphony, visit philipstudios.com. Thank you so much for listening.